Good evening, I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is away. On the NewsHour tonight, Venezuela becomes embroiled in a political standoff after both Nicolas Maduro's ruling party and the opposition claim victory in that country's presidential election. President Biden proposes major changes to the U.S. Supreme Court, including term limits.
We need these reforms to restore trust in the court, preserve the system of checks and balances that are vital to our democracy.
And how the Trump and Harris campaign messages are resonating with voters fewer than 100 days before the election. Welcome to the NewsHour. The U.S. says it has serious concerns about the election results in Venezuela. That's after Venezuela's authoritarian leader, Nicolas Maduro, declared a victory in a tumultuous presidential race. Exit polls in yesterday's voting showed a blowout win for the opposition party. Now, both Maduro and the opposition have claimed a win, but most world leaders have held back from recognizing the results. Even before the official results, the headlines were set and the papers went to print. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro claimed another 6 years in office.
This really caught my attention. It was not what you would expect. At least I did not expect it.
And there was good reason for that surprise on the otherwise quiet streets of Caracas. Last night's exit polls told a different story, showing that Maduro's main challenger, Edmundo González, would win by a large margin. Opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who championed González after she was banned from running by Venezuela's Supreme Court, declared his victory.
Edmundo González Urrutia got 70% of the votes in this election, and Nicolas Maduro received 30% of the votes. This is the truth. And, my dear Venezuelans, this is the Venezuelan election with the largest margin of victory in history.
As the polls closed on Sunday night, opposition supporters tried to witness the count. But scuffles broke out as Maduro's supporters showed up to push them back. Hours after voting ended, the Maduro-controlled National Election Authority declared him the winner, with 51% of the vote, and 44% for González, who vowed to continue his fight.
What happened during today's polling day was a violation of all the rules, to the point that the majority of electoral registers have still not been handed over.
The Venezuelan electoral body made a Maduro win official today, but the opposition has argued for more transparency.
Maria Corina Machado and Edmundo González have all the records and numbers. It's just a matter of reviewing them. That is why we are asking for a review of each record to uncover the truth.
Machado and González presented the biggest challenge to the United Socialist Party since the revolutionary Hugo Chavez took office more than 25 years ago. Venezuela was once the most advanced economy in Latin America, with the world's largest oil reserves. But since Chavez died and his protege Maduro took office in 2013, Venezuela has spiraled amid devastating inflation, economic collapse, and alleged human rights abuses. 7.7 million Venezuelans have left the country, almost a third of the population. Many world leaders have denounced or discounted Maduro's announced victory.
The international community is watching this very closely and will respond accordingly.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken negotiated with Maduro to ease American sanctions on Venezuela's state-owned oil and gas industries in exchange for a commitment to free and fair elections. Blinken addressed the results on a trip to Asia today.
We have serious concerns that the result announced does not reflect the will or the votes of the Venezuelan people.
But Maduro appears undeterred.
A triumph of the national independence, the dignity of the Venezuelan people. The sanctions made weren't enough. Aggressions against us weren't enough. Threats weren't enough. Not today, and those will never be enough against the dignity of the Venezuelan people.
And we are joined now by Ricardo Zuniga, founding partner of Dinamica Americas. That's an international advisory group. He's also a former State Department official who served as President Obama's principal advisor for the Americas. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with your reaction to Nicolas Maduro's declaration of victory in Venezuela.
Well, Maduro knows, and so does everyone else in Venezuela and outside of Venezuela, that he lost this election in a landslide to Edmundo González. At this point, he's doing what he can, apparently, to try to change the facts on the ground. But he did that in 2018. I don't think he's stronger today than he was in 2018, and certainly not even stronger than he was yesterday. So he's trying to essentially cement these facts, gather as many international allies as he can to support him, unsuccessfully for the most part, and essentially steal this election.
What options are available to the U.S. as it weighs its response? Because till now, sanctions had been the main leverage point.
Well, sanctions were one point of leverage, and they were designed exactly as that, as one part of the option. Diplomatic negotiations with the Maduro team, but also basically coalescing a larger group of international actors, especially from the Americas and Europe, to try to pressure for democratic change and support democratic actors in Venezuela. That is an important source of leverage for the United States. There's also the fact that conditions regionally have changed dramatically over time. There is very, very little support regionally for the government that he is going to try to reimpose.
Well, how instrumental are those regional players like Brazil, Colombia, Chile, all of whom they've demanded to see a total vote tally here?
Well, they have. And so what Maduro is trying to do today is really eliminate that vote tally as a real factor at all by establishing facts on the ground through the use of force and through the theft of ballot boxes, a very old style approach to election theft with very little guile. But those actors, those regional actors, remain extremely important. And what Brazil says, what Colombia says, is going to weigh a lot. These are important trading partners for Venezuela. They share not just borders, but a lot of interests in common. They're also the destination for millions of Venezuelans who have left that collapsing state.
Meantime, China and Russia are rallying behind Maduro. What are the implications there?
Well, unfortunately, that's going to continue this farce of an election. That is going to provide some vital support. But they also have to look at Maduro as a weakened leader. At the end of the day, he allowed an election that demonstrated just how weak he is internally. And those are not the only ones. His domestic allies will also be weighing that weakness.
Yeah. What's the path forward, or is there a path forward now for the opposition? And what does all of this mean for the people of Venezuela who are desperate for change?
There is certainly a path forward. I think that everyone in Venezuela knows that Edmundo González won this election, that there is massive domestic support for change in Venezuela, and as there should be. Almost 8 million Venezuelans have left the country in recent years. And so now I think there's going to be an increasing demand for change, not a decreasing demand. There is a sense that the 2018 election, which was won under very questionable terms by Maduro, that's not the way forward. I think that the pressure for change is only going to grow. And there are different institutions in Venezuela, like the armed forces, that are going to have to make some difficult decisions about where they stand.
Ricardo Zuniga, thanks so much for your insights this evening. Yes. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And we start the day's other headlines in the Middle East, where Israel's prime minister has warned of severe consequences for a strike in the Golan Heights that killed 12 children. Israel says Hezbollah fired the rocket from Lebanon, but Hezbollah denies responsibility. Israel seized the Golan Heights from Syria in 1967 during the Six-Day War. Since then, Israeli troops have used it as a strategic position given its high elevation and proximity to Syria and Lebanon. Today, at the soccer field where the deadly attack took place, protesters chanted "Get out" as Netanyahu paid a visit and vowed retaliation.
Hezbollah, backed by Iran, fired here an Iranian missile that took the lives of 12 pure souls. These are our children, the children of all of us, and the state of Israel will not and cannot ignore this. Our response will come, and it will be harsh.
The White House today urged Israel to show restraint amid concerns of a broader regional war. A spokesman for the White House National Security Council told reporters there is still time and space for a diplomatic solution. In northwest England, two children were killed and 11 others injured in a knife attack at a dance class today. The rampage took place in the seaside town of Southport outside of Liverpool. Police arrested a 17-year-old male on suspicion of murder and attempted murder. Six children and two adults are in critical condition. The town's chief constable described it as a ferocious attack.
It is understood that the children were attending a Taylor Swift event at a dance school when the offender, armed with a knife, walked into the premises and started to attack inside the children. We believe that the adults who were injured were bravely trying to protect the children who were being attacked.
Police have not yet identified a motive for the attack, but they do not believe it was terror-related. Here in the U.S., California officials say the Park Fire has become the sixth largest blaze in state history. Firefighters reported some progress over the weekend, but it's still spreading. The inferno has burned more than 100 structures across an area of Northern California that's larger than the city of Los Angeles. Among the communities warned to evacuate is the town of Paradise, which was devastated by the Camp Fire back in 2018. Authorities say this latest fire was ignited when a man pushed a burning car into a gully last week. A suspect has since been arrested. A judge in New York has decided not to appoint an outside monitor to oversee the finances and internal operations at the National Rifle Association. But Judge Joel Cohen did ban former NRA chief Wayne LaPierre from working there for 10 years. The ruling came during the second phase of a civil case brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James. During the first phase earlier this year, a jury found that LaPierre had misspent millions of NRA dollars on personal expenses. He was ordered to repay more than $4 million. U.S. health regulators approved the first blood test for colon cancer today. It's called SHIELD, and it's intended for adults aged 45 and older. The test detected 83% of cancers, according to a study published earlier this year, but it's not a replacement for colonoscopies, which are still preferred by doctors. Colorectal cancer is the second most common form of cancer death in the U.S., expected to kill more than 53,000 people this year alone. On Wall Street today, stocks ended mostly unchanged as investors look ahead to Wednesday's Federal Reserve meeting. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 50 points, so just a fraction lower. The NASDAQ added 12 points ahead of some major tech earnings this week. The S&P 500 also ended virtually flat. In Olympics news, Novak Djokovic bested longtime rival Rafael Nadal in a showdown on the court today. It was the 60th head-to-head match between the two tennis legends, and possibly their last. The outcome ends Nadal's singles run in Paris, but he's still set to compete in the doubles competition. In gymnastics, the American men ended a 16-year medal drought in the team competition, earning a bronze. But it's been a slow start for the triathletes in Paris. Organizers canceled their training session in the Seine for a second day, citing pollution levels and current speeds.
There's been quite a lot of rain, including during the opening ceremony.
We've done everything we could in relation with the International Federation, but also with the public authorities to achieve the goal of having the Swimbowl Seine, and it's going to be a fantastic legacy for later. And we're still optimistic that we can hold the competition within the Seine River.
As for where things stand on the overall Olympic leaderboard, the U.S. tops the table in total medals with 20 so far. That includes three golds. Host nation France has 16 medals, including five golds, and Japan is currently third. And tonight, a passing of note. Civic leader Alma Powell, who was the widow of former Secretary of State Colin Powell, has died. She was a devoted military spouse who reportedly played a key role in convincing her husband not to run for president back in 1996. 5 years later, she stood by his side while he was sworn in as U.S. Secretary of State. Later on, Mrs. Powell served on many boards, including President Obama's Board of Advisors on Historically Black Colleges, and she was chair emeritus of America's Promise Alliance, a nonprofit founded by her husband that helps underserved youth. Alma Powell was 86 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, Donald Trump's shifting stance on cryptocurrency. Amy Walter and Tamara Keith analyze the latest from the Trump and Harris campaigns. And Olympic speed skater Apollo Ohno on prioritizing athletes' mental health.
This is the PBS NewsHour. from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West, from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
It's only been a week since the 2024 race for the White House was upended, but it's already entering the final countdown. Now fewer than 100 days until Election Day. In the last couple of days, the Republican ticket, that's Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, hit the campaign trail together while Vice President Kamala Harris spent her first full weekend as the likely Democratic nominee. Here's Lisa Desjardins.
Because we have a lot to talk about.
Tonight, Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign is basking in the glow of a colossal fundraising haul and a new surge in the polls. Her campaign announced yesterday that it had raised over $200 million in the first week of her candidacy. That's more than the Trump campaign raised in the entire month of June. And Team Harris got a boost in manpower, saying more than 170,000 volunteers signed up. But even with that, at a Massachusetts fundraiser this weekend, Harris warned against overconfidence.
We're the underdogs in this race. But this is a people power campaign. And we have momentum.
Those signs of energy are also showing up in the polls. A new ABC News Ipsos poll shows voters warming up to Harris fast, with 43% favorability. That number was 35% just a week ago. The jump was especially pronounced among independents, now with 44% viewing Harris favorably. That's up by 16 points.
Are you ready to elect Kamala Harris president of the United States of America?
Stumping for Harris on the trail this weekend, a number of high-profile surrogates who are also among her potential running mates. The VP could pick her VP as soon as this week. The blitz of events and messaging, including what the campaign dubbed a weekend of action, include a new angle of attack against opponents Donald Trump and J.D. Vance.
But we're not afraid of weird people.
No.
We're a little bit creeped out, but we're not afraid.
Donald Trump has been resorting to some wild lies about my record and some of what he and his running mate are saying. Well, it's just plain weird.
But Team Trump is also hitting the trail hard, with Trump holding three major appearances since Friday, starting with the former president and his number two appearing together in Minnesota. That's a state that hasn't voted for a Republican for president in over 50 years. But Trump wants to redraw the map, even as he himself writes new attack lines.
We have a brand new victim. And honestly, she's a radical left lunatic. She has no clue. She has no clue. She's evil.
Since the attempt on his life, Trump has only had events at indoor venues, including this one in Minnesota. But he has vowed to return to Butler, Pennsylvania, where the shooting happened, for a rally at a later date. And today, the FBI said the former president has agreed to be interviewed as part of their investigation into the shooting. But over the weekend, many Trump allies also had to explain these comments Trump made to a gathering of Christian conservatives on Friday.
Christians, get out and vote just this time. You won't have to do it anymore. Four more years, you know what? It'll be fixed. It'll be fine. You won't have to vote anymore, my beautiful Christians. I love you, Christians.
A spokesman said Trump was talking about uniting the country. Running mate J.D. Vance gave an explanation Sunday.
So I think he's saying, get out there, make sure this election matters, because if you don't, the next 4 years, we may not have a real election if the Democrats give illegal aliens the right to vote.
Harris and Trump will both campaign in battleground states in the next few days, and with just 99 days left in the race, every day counts. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
Meantime, President Biden is unveiling three proposed reforms in response to legal, ethical, and political controversies swirling around the U.S. Supreme Court. Namely, finding former presidents are largely immune from criminal prosecution, gifts received and initially unreported by justices, and the makeup of the court itself. President Biden called for the changes at an event in Austin, Texas this afternoon.
We can and must be protected and expand our civil rights in America. We can and must prevent the abuse of presidential power and restore faith in the Supreme Court. We can and must strengthen the guardrails of democracy.
Our White House correspondent, Laura Barrón-López, joins us now to unpack all of this. Good to see you, Laura. So what is President Biden proposing, and how does this all work?
So this was a long time coming for President Biden, and today he endorsed major reforms to the Supreme Court, including term limits for Supreme Court justices, a binding code of conduct for Supreme Court justices, and then a constitutional amendment that would make it so there is no presidential immunity from prosecution for crimes committed while in office. And for the term limits, it would make it so a president could appoint a justice every 2 years, and they would spend 18 years on the court rather than receiving a lifetime appointment. And then when it comes to the code of ethics, the justices would have to recuse themselves from cases in which they or their spouses have financial or other conflicts of interest. And of course, that immunity, the presidential immunity constitutional amendment, is in response to the Supreme Court ruling that a president has broad immunity for official acts.
So the White House says these proposals are popular, but are they politically feasible?
So all of these would have to be passed through Congress, Jeff. And most Republicans in Congress have opposed reforms like this. House Speaker Mike Johnson said today that these proposals would be dead on arrival in the House. And to pass these, any Democratic president would need to have strong majorities in both chambers. Specifically, two of these would have to be passed through constitutional amendment, the term limits, as well as the presidential immunity amendment. And that would require a two-thirds majority of both chambers and three quarters of state legislators to ratify constitutional amendments.
So here's one question, Laura. Why now? Because as you well know, President Biden had resisted Supreme Court reform for a long time.
This is an election year, Jeff, and so this is a big way for President Biden to essentially rally the base to Democrats. It's something that progressives have pushed him on since the 2020 campaign. They have wanted to see him endorse some Supreme Court reforms. They, of course, really wanted, he faced a lot of pressure, to expand the number of justices on the Supreme Court. And I spoke to Bob Bauer, who sat on the president's Supreme Court Reform Commission a few years ago, and Bob Bauer said that court expansion would further erode the public's confidence in the Supreme Court.
I don't think that there is much of a future to the proposals for court packing or court expansion. I think on the merits, there are more negatives than positives. We saw support for term limits in a way that we didn't see for court expansion or court packing from left and right, Democrats and Republicans. Quite wide support reflected in the record that we created for the commission.
As Bob Bauer said there, much more bipartisan support for term limits for justices. And also recently, Justice Kagan acknowledged that she thought that there should be a binding code of ethics for justices, but the enforcement mechanism is the thing that Justice Kagan said would be difficult, saying that potentially it could be lower court judges that end up enforcing that for the Supreme Court.
Is this something that Vice President Harris, the likely Democratic nominee, is this something that she will champion?
It is. So Vice President Harris quickly endorsed this, Jeff, after the president released the proposal. She said that, quote, these popular reforms will help to restore confidence in the court, strengthen our democracy, and ensure no one is above the law. So she is squarely behind President Biden on this. And again, her campaign feels that this is a way to energize the base. Democrats now are trying to make the Supreme Court a wedge issue the way Republicans have in the past, and they feel that it's a good possibility for them to do this, especially after the fall of Roe v. Wade.
Laura Barrón-López, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. This weekend, cryptocurrency's largest annual conference took place in Nashville, Tennessee. It was a gathering of leaders, celebrities, tech industry insiders, and crypto enthusiasts. But former President Trump and independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. spoke in favor of boosting crypto during their remarks there. As William Brangham tells us, those speeches may be aimed at getting support this fall from tech leaders and startups who have a growing voice on these issues.
That's right, Jeff. The incredible rise of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have created a new block of mega donors that voters and presidential candidates are now trying to win over. Former President Trump, who initially denounced cryptocurrency as, quote, highly volatile and based on thin air back in 2019, reversed himself in his speech to the conference last Saturday by promising to make the U.S. the crypto capital of the world.
If crypto is going to define the future, I want to be mined, minted, and made in the USA. It's going to be. It's not going to be made anywhere else. And if Bitcoin is going to the moon, as we say, it's going to the moon, I want America to be the nation that leads the way. And that's what's going to happen. No, you're going to be very happy with me.
Joining me now to discuss the ramifications of all of this is David Yaffe Bellany from The New York Times. David, thank you so much for being here. Help set the table for us, for people who have not been following us this that closely. Remind us of where crypto was after its big fall, and now it's sort of resurged in the marketplace.
The last time most ordinary people tuned into the crypto industry, you know, top executives were going to prison, the market was in free fall, and a lot of these kind of risky investments had been widely dismissed as worthless or scams. But a lot has changed since then. In January, the federal government approved a new investment product that's tied to the price of Bitcoin. And when that product started trading, it kind of opened up access to the crypto market to a whole lot of people who hadn't invested in it before. And as a result, the price of Bitcoin surged. It reached its record high a few months ago, and the prices of some of the other big crypto tokens have followed suit. And so the industry is in a much healthier state today than it has been for the last couple of years.
So as we just heard, the former President Trump made this very explicit pitch to the crypto world, saying, I might have been a skeptic before, but now I'm in full bore. What is his pitch, and why is this happening now?
Look, the crypto industry is furious about the way that it's been treated by the federal government. The Securities and Exchange Commission has embarked on a pretty aggressive crackdown on crypto companies, a crackdown so severe that it's essentially an existential threat. It could drive the industry out of the United States if it's successful. And so the embrace of Trump is really a response to that. And, you know, a cynical reading of this is that Trump is kind of opportunistically seizing on what's happening, you know, under the current administration, you know, seeing an opportunity to attract donor dollars from the crypto industry. And sort of that's why he's making this pitch, promising that, you know, he's going to turn the U.S. into a kind of inviting sort of capital for crypto companies, you know, rather than the sort of, you know, aggressive cop on the beat that it's been over the last couple of years.
Let's talk about that cop on the beat. Currently, that's the Biden administration's cop on the beat. What is it that they're doing, and what is their argument about why they need to be such a tough cop?
Sure. So, you know, the leader of this push is the chair of the SEC, Gary Gensler. And the argument that he has made over and over is that most cryptocurrencies are essentially securities, which is to say that they're just like stocks and bonds that are traded on Wall Street, and that they ought to be regulated as such, and that crypto companies should have to make all the sorts of disclosures and follow all the same rules as people who offer those traditional investment products. You know, that is a legal argument that the crypto industry hates. You know, they're fighting back against it, saying that if the SEC beats them in the courts on this issue, then they'll be driven out of the United States. So that's sort of the crux of the debate. And, you know, Trump went in front of a crowd of Bitcoin supporters over the weekend and said, one of my first acts as president will be to fire Gary Gensler. And it got probably the biggest cheer of the day.
So do we know what Vice President Kamala Harris might do if she were elected? Is it safe to say she would just continue the Biden administration's current approach?
It's hard to say for sure. You know, she hasn't said a ton publicly about her views on crypto, but obviously she's part of the current administration. And so a lot of crypto insiders are kind of assuming that if she wins, it'll be more of the same that they saw under the Biden administration. With that said, you know, both the Biden campaign and now the Harris campaign have extended something of an olive branch to crypto companies, sort of invited them to come to the table and sort of talk about the policy changes they would like to see. But, you know, the reaction among crypto executives has been pretty skeptical. You know, essentially it's been, your talk means nothing to us. You know, we've seen what you've done over the last 4 years, and frankly, we don't trust you.
We're talking about crypto here, but there has been in the broader tech world, as well as in the VC world, the venture capital world, the seeming move towards Trump and supporting Republican candidates. Is that all about this concern over too strict enforcement as they see it?
that's really probably the key part of this. Even tech people who aren't directly involved in the crypto industry sort of see what's going on and say, you know, this is an administration that's cracking down on innovation. And, you know, there's a fear that there might be a crackdown on, you know, the AI companies that are proliferating now. And so that's a lot of what's driving the kind of rightward shift of the Silicon Valley elite toward Trump. But there are other factors as well. You know, a lot of these top figures in the tech world have kind of bought into concerns about cancel culture and, you know, wokeness run amok. And so there are some of those kind of cultural issues at play here as well.
And I'm sure it's also true that billionaires like tax cuts, which Donald Trump is promising more of as well.
That's for sure.
David Yaffe Bellany of The New York Times, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And for some analysis of one of the busiest weeks of the 2024 presidential race so far, it's our Politics Monday team. That's Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Hello, hello.
Hello.
So Vice President Harris's campaign launch was greeted with enthusiasm, energy, and a ton of money from Democrats, Tam. The question is, how can her campaign sustain this momentum for the next 99 days into Election Day?
Right. Well, the good news for them is that there's only 99 days until Election Day. The campaign says that they got 100 and... So sorry. You go.
$180 million, right? Something
almost
like that.
$200 million.
$200 million to do that. Look, there has been, we were talking about this before we went on air, there has been a pent-up enthusiasm among Democrats for someone, anybody, who could prosecute the case against Donald Trump. They have that now in Kamala Harris. But do you want, okay, and then I'm going to keep going. And they finally have that ability in Kamala Harris to make that case. Now, look, I think that's not the part that she has to be as concerned about right now, is keeping enthusiasm up among Democrats, because it's not as, some of it is about her, but it's really, as it's long been, about not being Donald Trump and having somebody who can make the case against Donald Trump.
One more question for you, Amy, as Tim, you recover. How are you doing?
Yeah.
Working on it.
Okay. So we've seen this polling shift recently. VP Harris is within 1 point of Trump with likely voters. And this is a major improvement when you look at where President Biden was. He was behind 6 points after the debate just a month ago. Is this national shift something that we're seeing in battleground states as well?
Yeah, not as dramatic as that, but what we're seeing in some of the battleground state polls that have come out in this last week is a shift 2 to 3 points in Harris's favor, which is good news if you're Kamala Harris. But as we discussed with this enthusiasm question, the real challenge, I think, going forward for Harris isn't that she got the base consolidated. Well, actually, let me be fair. It wasn't always a given that the base would be consolidated. So in 1 week, to go from being the vice president, who maybe could be, we don't know if she's going to be able to do this, to she's now gotten the base behind her, is something that I think was surprising to a lot of people, including a lot of Republicans who are hoping for a more dramatic less unifying experience. Mm-hmm. But now she has to go the next step. So getting you 2 to 3 points or in that national poll, moving 4 or 5 points, gets you in the margin, but it doesn't get her ahead. So she's got to make now the sell to the swing voters.
Got it. So we are expecting sometime in the next week for VP Harris to name her running mate. She has to do it before August 7th to get the ticket on all 50 state ballots. Who among the reported shortlist do you think boosts the Democratic ticket in those battlegrounds?
In those, well, it goes back to my previous point about what do you need to do with your VP candidate? Do you need to keep the base energized and excited? I don't really think so. Remember, Donald Trump's pick of Mike Pence was because he had a base problem. Evangelicals were not sold on Donald Trump. They didn't believe that he was going to follow through on many of the promises that he had made on the campaign trail. So Pence was the person to bring those voters in. Harris, I don't think, has to worry about where are Democrats going to be. Is the party unified? Instead, she needs somebody to maybe soften the edges of her record. Now, look, we're hearing President Trump on the former President Trump on the campaign trail Republicans who are running down ballot, attacking her as somebody who's way, way, way to the left. I think Trump called her the most liberal person who has ever run for president. So getting somebody who's more of a centrist is what I think becomes more critical, which puts a lot of those names like Mark Kelly and Josh Shapiro in the mix.
Well, let's talk about Donald Trump's selection of J.D. Vance, because J.D. Vance is getting a lot of scrutiny now for his controversial comments about women without children. He called them childless cat ladies, said they're miserable with their own lives. He said this years ago while he was running for the Ohio Senate seat.
Right.
But he has not disavowed the comments, and he said in a podcast just the other day that he stands by the substance of what he said. There are lots of Democrats now who are more than happy to target J.D. Vance, including the Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer.
Vance seems to be more erratic and more extreme than President Trump. And I'll bet President Trump is sitting there scratching his head and wondering, why did I pick this guy? The choice may be one of the best things he ever did for Democrats.
And Chuck Schumer, we should say, is the majority leader. I have a lot in my head at the moment. So I was trying to think, what year is this? Who actually controls the Senate? In any case, has J.D. Vance, how are you doing, Tam?
I think I'm better.
All right, there we go.
Warm water with the cold water, and we're going to make it.
You know, our viewers were concerned. So. Has J.D. Vance become a liability for Republicans?
He has had a really terrible, no good week. He has somehow galvanized people who own cats, you know, at the... I covered Harris at this fundraiser she went to. There were people outside of her fundraiser holding up signs that said, cat ladies for Kamala Harris. This is after essentially he has a long file of things that he has said back when it didn't matter what he said because he wasn't going to be vice president. He was the author of a book and a guy running for the Senate in, you know, a Republican primary. And so at one point he had said that, people who, I think he called Harris a woman without children, a cat lady, and others who don't have children who should somehow have less political power than those who do. And that just set people off. Now, maybe those people were never going to vote for Trump. But generally speaking, with your vice presidential pick, you either want it to be additive or you want it to be a wash. You don't want it to be negative. And what Trump now has is voters, everyone, the media, very focused on Vice President Harris and this huge amount of fundraising she had. And then all the remaining oxygen is going to his vice presidential pick and his very bad, no good week and all the crazy things he's saying or said 5 years ago that have now become memes.
Yeah. And it allows Democrats to settle on this new messaging where it's not just offensive, it's also really weird. We keep hearing like Democrats like Tim Walz and Brian Schatz and even Vice President Kamala Harris has said on the stump that the things that Trump and Vance and other Republicans have said are just, it's just weird. Dissect that as a strategy.
Well, we talked about this so much when we were at the convention together, Jeff. Like, his pick of J.D. Vance was a sign of supreme confidence. Like, we got this in the bag. We don't need to reach out to swing voters. I'm not really worried about those because we're winning. And he wasn't put on the ticket to make up for some deficits that Trump may have or to win over new voters. He was put on as an additive onto Trump. And so... of course, he's turned off swing voters because he was never brought on to appeal to swing voters, and he's never had to. Remember, his race in Ohio, this is a race he did win pretty handily, and yet for a state as Republican as that, he didn't have to ever kind of tack to the middle, and he did not win by as big of a percentage as given where the state is, as he could have or should have.
Tim, earlier we were talking about the Vice President Harris's shortlist for running mates.
Yeah.
Based on your reporting, who's on the shortest of shortlists at this point?
Well, the shortlist is still quite long, is what my reporting tells me. We have two sources we've spoken to who are familiar with Harris's thinking, and they say that she hasn't narrowed the list down. It's about a dozen people. That decision will be made quite soon, though, and that the qualities she's looking for, among others, are executive experience and the ability to be a governing partner with her, as she sees herself as a governing partner with President Biden. That could be a lot of people, but it certainly points in the direction of governors who have executive experience.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Tamara Keith and Amy Walter, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Millions of people are closely watching the performance of Olympic great Simone Biles as she competes for gold. Biles' stunning athletic feats are the primary reason, of course, but she has also helped open the door wider to conversations around mental health and the incredible pressure to compete, as have other Olympic greats like Michael Phelps, Naomi Osaka, and Jamie Anderson. Amna had a conversation just before the Games began with Apollo Ohno, the most decorated American Olympian of the Winter Games. He's now an entrepreneur and motivational speaker.
Apollo Ohno, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you are so respected and so admired, not only by so many fans, but also by so many athletes looking to follow in your footsteps. I'm curious, have any of this year's Olympians reached out to you looking for advice? And if so, what kind of questions do they ask you?
Well, I mean, first off, I'm honored that you would say that. You know, my competing days feel like a lifetime ago, and I get probably just as excited as anyone else who's watching this new or resurging group of athletes go and compete again in Paris. I don't communicate with that many of this, I would say, this team. You know, obviously, I'm a Winter Olympic athlete, so a lot of my existing relationships go back into that realm. But I'll be in Paris, and I'll be cheering those athletes on, and it'll be very interesting to see, given all of what has happened over the past 4 years globally, both on terms of what is in these athletes' minds, how they prepared, the entire landscape of the world, how much have people gone through in terms of resilience. And it's, I think we need these games. We need these games badly.
What do you mean by that when you say we need these games? And especially for these athletes who, as you say, have been coming out of these last few years when we know we've seen a worsening of a mental health crisis. I know this is something you talk about a lot, and resilience. What are you looking for in these athletes? What do you want to say?
Well, I think we saw this conversation around the destigmatization of the word mental health and people who suffer or are in a place where they feel like they don't have the resources, they don't have access, and that they're not okay. And there's usually a long lag that is associated with that. And I think that we're seeing, obviously, all the effects with social pressure of these different tribal kind of extreme views and subscriptions to whatever belief systems that you have. And it feels like sort of a fractured time in society. And the beautiful part about what the Olympics is supposed to embody and stand for is this unification globally around providing a platform for these athletes to showcase their best physicality and their best mental component. And as we saw, some of the greatest athletes in the world bowing out of competition at the height of their, in the peak of their careers, and it took back some by surprise. And so the games are required and needed, I believe, because sport is a unifier. It is a place that brings the world together and at least gives us a 2-week period of time where we can breathe, we can cheer, we can see the amazing feats of these amazing men and women from around the world.
What was it like when you were coming up? Could you have conversations around mental health?
Well, I think, you know, obviously, you know, with every athlete that is retired, I'm 14 years retired now, and I kind of look back at my career and I say, well, you know, back when I did it in my day, it was a very different conversation. But the reality is the resources were not at the priority of what the athletes needed, required, or to be completely frank, we didn't know what that even meant. The words mental health really was mental performance. That's where we focus a lot of our time. The prize is obviously very important. That's why there's only 3 spots on a podium, gold, silver, and bronze. We pay attention to that medal count more so ever today than we did in the past. But we can never lose sight of the powerful form of the journey to get there. Because I can tell you, almost 15 years retired, when I look back on my career, I don't really remember standing on top of the podium. The memories are there, they're ingrained. But the most powerful were the times when no one was watching, when it was behind the curtain, when it was me against myself, digging, striving, trying to find that extra 1%. And I think that's what people can derive from these experiences, is that while we might not always be able to control these outcomes, in that process is where the true prize can actually be.
Tell me more about your own personal experience then, because when you go all in, as you have to compete at that level, what does it mean for you when you decide to change paths, as you did when you decided to retire, to leave this sport that had defined so much of you for so long? What was that like?
Yeah, if I can give you an example, you know, I wrote a book called Hard Pivot, and there's a chapter in the book, and it's called The Great Divorce. And, you know, imagine, and everyone will go through some significant hard pivot, some loss of identity or loss in general, a loved one, a situation, financial, some hardship. And that great divorce that I'm speaking from experience was in the back of my head. I have to tell you, there had been hundreds of people that had said, Apollo, prepare for what you will do after sport. And in my head, I could not wrap my head around what I wanted to do post-sport. There wasn't anything I wanted to do. I felt like my purpose, my being, my entire ethos on this planet was to go around in circles on these speed skates wearing these superhero outfits, right? I didn't know how ridiculous that really meant back then, but that was the power of belief in that moment. But when you retire, either by force or by choice, those guardrails go flat. And now you have the athlete kind of swimming in the sea of unknown. They don't know who they are. They don't know what skill set that they have developed yet. There has been no professional coaching, and many have put off any collegiate or academic studies in lieu of pursuing their dream of becoming and representing the United States at the Olympic Games. And that comes with some sort of a cost, as with everything in life. And so for me, there was no plan B. And so for all of those athletes who will be going into Paris, into these Olympic Games, and preparing for the retirement after, nothing that I will say to them will resonate until those feelings of quiet, of solemn, when all the lights have dissipated, when the sponsors are no longer calling, when the agent has gone on to the next great athlete, the next great story, and you're left with yourself. But they have to remember that within this is this untamed potential and reservoir of opportunity that they have to restart again.
Apollo Ohno, still out here leading and inspiring so many people in the ways you do. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Thanks talking to you.
One of the Hollywood box office stars of the summer is a 94-year-old actress, a veteran of stage and screen, but now in her very first starring role. June Squibb talks to our Jeffrey Brown about aging on screen and in life for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Grandma.
Danny? You sound so strange.
I'm in jail.
Oh, my God.
In the movie Thelma, 94-year-old June Squibb plays 93-year-old Thelma Post, victim of an online scam that targets older people, who decides to take matters into her own hands.
I'm going to get it back.
I need a ride.
When Squibb first read the script, she says it was a no-brainer to take it on.
It had this wonderful woman in her 90s who was ready to gung-ho all over L.A. to get her money back. And I just felt, oh, God, such grit, such determination, and showing age.
And how did you think this was real?
Mom, you thought it was real, too.
Well, she was very convincing.
The film, written and directed by Josh Margolin, is based on his real-life grandmother, who just turned 104. We see Thelma having lost her husband with family, especially her somewhat lost but loving grandson, and other aging friends. Most of all, Ben, played by Richard Roundtree, best known as Detective John Shaft in the 1970s film series.
Why are we stopping at malls?
To get a gun.
Do you even know how to use it?
How hard can it be? Idiots use them all the time.
God.
The two take off across Los Angeles on the trail of the scammers, and the film gleefully riffs on Tom Cruise-like Mission Impossible chase scenes, but now on a rather slow-moving motorized scooter. Squibb insisted on doing some of her own stunts, including driving the scooter.
I live in a complex, an apartment complex, and there's a road around it, and the stunt coordinator, the director, the producers were all here with me on the scooter riding around this oval. And the stunt coordinator was running beside me. They were scared to death I was going to kill myself. But I got pretty good on it. The stunt coordinator kept saying, June, you can stop it on a dime. So that became my sort of mantra, stop on a dime, Squibb.
Stop on a dime, June Squibb is having quite a summer. She's also the voice of nostalgia in the animated film Inside Out 2, a massive box office hit, the year's biggest so far.
Remember when we all finally came up to headquarters?
Nostalgia.
That was like 30 seconds ago, nostalgia.
Yeah, those were the days.
She spent decades in a wide variety of stage roles on and off Broadway. Her move to the screen came late, and then always in smaller supporting roles, such as Scent of a Woman with Al Pacino. She played Lena Dunham's grandmother in the HBO series Girls.
Someday you will look at him, hating him with every fiber of your being. It will pass.
This is Cate Grant.
Her best-known role to date came in the film Nebraska in 2013 as the wife of an increasingly delusional man played by Bruce Dern, which gained her an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actress.
These boys grow up staring at the rear ends of cows and pigs.
Look at that. I mean, who created that? Who thought it up? A plug for a car. Electricity goes through, makes it run.
Thelma, in fact, is her first starring role.
Does that surprise you to even think about that, to contemplate that?
It surprises me that it's become such a point of interest to people, because it's not a point of interest to me, basically. I always choose what I'm going to do. There are certain reasons why I want to do certain films. It's the material for me. It's not leading role, supporting role, you know, all those words. It's what the woman is as I'm reading it.
We're old, diminished. The least we can do is take care of each other.
Playing this woman, Squibb says, felt deeply personal. For all the comedy, this is also a film about aging and family ties and strains, about lost loved ones, about loneliness and holding on to purpose. Squibb and her second husband were together for 30 years before his death in 1999.
I recognized immediately some of the things that Thelma was feeling and going through, and I've already been through some of them. So, it became personal. It became very personal.
What do you see with the movies generally? Do the movies get aging right, do you think?
I think we're doing it more and more. The studios, the people that make decisions, are seeing that people are interested in aging.
But on the other hand, we always hear that older people can become invisible in our culture.
Well, I think they do. I think that it's easy to have a grandmother, an aunt, or somebody in the family. And as they get older, I think that they're less listened to. You know, they're less important, perhaps. What they think is less important. But I think that that might be changing, too. I mean, we're breaking all the rules with this film. And that's what it's all about, is if you can break rules then and make money at it. I mean, you know, we're doing beautifully at the box office.
You've said that you felt in the past that you constantly had to prove yourself, and you no longer feel that anymore.
Well, the audition process that we all went through in our younger years, it's very difficult. And you're constantly being said, prove to me that you should do this role. I think that as we get older, we drop a lot of that. We don't really, for one thing, I really care little what anybody thinks anymore. So I have that sort of security within me that what I'm thinking, what my wishes are and what my wants are enough.
One poignant coda: after filming ended, co-star Richard Roundtree died of pancreatic cancer at age 81. As for June Squibb, she's already wrapped filming her second starring role in Eleanor the Great, the upcoming directorial debut by Scarlett Johansson.
No sense of retiring or stopping?
God knows I've slowed down, you know, but I have no idea. If somebody comes to me with something and it looks like I can do it and I want to do it, I will do it.
June Squibb is Thelma in theaters and streaming this summer. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
What?
I didn't say anything. Huh?
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thanks for spending part of your evening with us. Have a good night.